So in fact, the question is not, when does human life start? The question is a different one. The question is, when is there a person that I have a duty to protect? Now, the reason for stressing that is that when you put the question like that, you realize it's not a biological question. You don't find a person by using an electron microscope. It's a much more profound question. It's basically a philosophical and theological question. And what it seems to me is that there is no point, as you go back in your own history, so just imagine in your thought experiment, go back into your own history, imagine yourself as a newborn baby, imagine yourself as a 28-week fetus, as a 12-week fetus, as a 6-week fetus, as a 6-day embryo, as a 3-day embryo. Is there any point at which you can reliably say, that is not me? And I think the short answer is, at least my conclusion, is there isn't. There isn't any point at which you can reliably say, that is not me. Even when you were a one-cell embryo, that was you. And if you're a Christian, God saw you and knew you and loved you and was calling you into existence. So I come to the conclusion that however far you go back, there's no point at which I can reliably say, this is not a person. And that leads me to feel, therefore, I am called on to try and protect this being. Even though I know that a significant, as many as 50% of embryos that are conceived when a couple are having normal sexual intercourse will fail to implant and are lost. Often the couple don't even know that a baby was there or an embryo was there, depending on what the language you want to use. It seems to me that I don't have the right to destroy life at however early a point. I'm happy to discuss that further. Also, if you're interested in that, you'll forgive me a bit of self-publicity, there's a book called Matters of Life and Death, which is there are copies at the back for £10. I've got a whole chapter called When is a Person, which really addresses that in more detail.
And just, flowing from that, John, a couple of questions on abortion then specifically. What do you make of the move to make abortion a woman's rights issue in recent years?
Well, I understand. Of course, this is a terribly painful issue. And I think the most important thing whenever we talk about abortion is to recognize the human pain. I think a lot of time you hear really harsh rhetoric and campaigning. And I think that's very unhelpful. And I think that abortion is one of those terrible agonizing points, which is like a scar in our society. I mean, 1 in 3 women will have an abortion in their lifetime. And for every woman, there is a man involved as well. And yet, this is a topic which is so rarely talked about. It's like it's just a hidden reality in our society, which damages lives. So, I think it's a huge challenge. But I think we need to respond not with harsh rhetoric and judgmentalism. We need to try and support. Actually, my wife runs a crisis pregnancy centre in North London, in Islington, where they offer free counselling and support advice for people with unplanned pregnancy and befriending and baby equipment for those who find the courage to go ahead and continue the pregnancy with all the challenges and issues that raises. Now, that seems to be a much more practical, compassionate response rather than engaging in a lot of rhetoric and campaigning.
Oh, thank you. John, I think this might be the single biggest, most common question raised here. I'll ask one of the ways it's been asked. Would resisting the modern tendency to control our human nature also lead you to resist medical treatment of illness? What is the difference between using technology to treat versus preventing illness? And lots of other questions about when would you say no to technologies, and given that it's been used to prevent so many illnesses.
Sure. So, and of course, this is a huge issue about, as technology advances, what is the appropriate use of technology? Now, an analogy which I've used, and which I think is helpful, although like all analogies, it has limitations, is that of art restoration. So if you take art restoration, people involved in art restoration use highly sophisticated technology and very artificial, invasive way. But, interestingly, art restorers have a code of ethics. And the code of ethics says that you must only use your technology according to the original artist's intention. So you're allowed to restore the masterpiece according to the original artist's intention, but you're not allowed to change the design. And that's just some kind of analogy, but I think if you think of the human person and the human body as in some way like a flawed masterpiece, using highly invasive technology in order to restore that masterpiece, so even if you're, for instance, directly manipulating the DNA code, or if you are growing an artificial organ which is designed to exactly replicate a human kidney, and so on and so on, arguably, at least, in principle, that is something that I think can be ethically justifiable, if your aim is to restore the human being back to normal. But if your aim is to change the fundamental nature of humanity, then I would argue that is changing the design. And that's, so the issue is not the technology, the issue is what is it being used for, what is the goal, what is the aim. And that is really what is often described as the difference between restorative intervention and enhancing intervention. Now, I totally accept that there are difficulties with that distinction. There are grey zones, you know, for instance, if you could make people totally resistant to HIV, would that be a restorative intervention? Would it be an enhancing intervention? And so on and so on. There are all kinds of grey and difficult issues. But I think if fundamentally the distinction between a restorative therapy and an enhancing therapy is a useful one to bear in mind. Mm-hmm. And therefore the limits of technology come when something about my fundamental human nature is changing. And, of course, there is matter for debate about what is human nature. But from a Christian or theistic position, if we believe that there is more to humanity than simply random forces over millions and billions of years, if there is some guiding principle as to what it means to be human, and I think, above all, if Jesus really is the Son of God, one of the ancient church fathers says the glory of God is a man fully alive. And he didn't just mean any man, he meant one particular man. He meant Jesus of Nazareth. Mm-hmm. And I think if that is true, you could say, you know, if that kind of body was good enough for Jesus, then it's good enough for me. I don't need to have one of these special enhanced, all singing, all dancing bodies. I mean, this original Mark I version is good enough for me.
This question's asking, how do you decide which technology compromises our humanity and which doesn't? E.g. mobile phones. Do our phones mine compromises my humanity because I don't know how to use it. That's the reason it does.
Well, and of course, this is a very interesting and difficult debate again. So, for instance, does it matter whether the technology is actually in the body or not? So, I mean, if so we all use smartphones. We can do amazing things with smartphones. You know, they get better all the time. They definitely do enhance our abilities, our ability to gain knowledge, our ability to be aware of our environment. We can just pull down a satellite view and see, you know, we change our perspective. Does it matter? I still want to say that that is fundamentally an appropriate use of technology. It's not changing the nature of my humanity. Would it matter if effectively the smartphone is implanted in my brain so that, you know, I've got a USB port here and I just sort of plug it in and then I can see in my mind the information coming direct from the cloud? I mean, is that changing my humanity? Is that different from holding it in your hand? And these are very difficult, complex issues. I don't see an easy answer, but I think we need to be having this kind of conversation and working out. I think virtual reality, for instance, is the power of, I don't know if any of you have experienced what modern virtual reality is like. I have, and it's absolutely extraordinary. And I think there is no doubt that there's going to be a huge push to experience more and more of our lives in a virtual way, and less of our lives in this kind of old-fashioned way where we're actually talking to one another. And perhaps, again, we're going to have to say, but actually, this old-fashioned way of meeting together and just talking face-to-face and sharing food together and enjoying human conversation and so on, actually, that's good enough. We don't need to live our lives in this totally alternative reality.
Mm, good. Now, John, there was a couple of questions on this issue. Where does the line stop between using God-given gifts to prolong life and then the medical profession playing God?
Yeah, so that, again, a huge debate about life extension. So a lot is now known about the aging process, and what's clear is the aging process is basically the accumulation of cellular defects and debris. You know, basically what happens is that you start from nothing, your body gets better and better and better, you're learning, you're growing, you're getting stronger, everything's getting more and more wonderful, and then you hit 25. And from 25 onwards, you are on the long, slow, downhill
trend. None of you have reached that stage yet, don't worry.
And bit by bit, your DNA debris is accumulating in your cells, and your cellular machinery is corroding and being oxidized, and bad things start to happen. And to begin with, all the damage is sort of invisible, but bit by bit, it starts to become visible, and you start to get wrinkles. And as you can see in me, the process of damage is quite advanced. eventually, the damage accumulates and gets more and more and more, and then you die. And that's it. Get with it. And so the question is, do we have to accept that? And, you know, if we can understand how to stop this DNA damage, if we can understand how to replace the bits that are decaying, how to renew them and so on. And there are people seriously talking about extending life not just to 120 years, but to 150, 180, 200, 250, even once we've cracked it, going on forever. And then the question is that actually good? Is that the way it was meant to be? I mean, from a Christian point of view, those of you who know your Bible will know that in the account in Genesis chapter 3, after the first man and woman had eaten the fruit of the tree of knowledge, they were driven out of the garden, and an angel and a flashing sword was put there to stop them getting back into the garden. And why was it there? The narrative says why the angel was stopping them getting back into the garden. Does anybody, you Bible scholars? So the narrative says that it was there to stop them getting back into the garden and eating of the fruit of the tree of life and living forever. So in Christian thinking, to live forever in a fallen world is not a blessing, it's a curse. And actually in biblical thinking, human life is curtailed in order to limit evil. And that's one of the great things about tyrants, isn't it? I mean, we have terrible tyrants in this world, but you know what? Eventually they die, and we get rid of them. So that death actually limits human evil. And I personally think, therefore, that the desire to extend life, that's not the Christian way. The Christian way of eternal life is actually through death and resurrection. It's not through technology, through life extension.
Yeah. Thanks, John. This is all so helpful. I've got two questions left. How do these Christian ideals shape how we create legislation around these issues? Linked to that, should Christians be involved in trying to shape legislation around these issues?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the questions you often get is, what right do you have to impose your views on the rest of society? You know, you're just some weird religious minority. You know, you should... You'll do whatever you like, but you, for goodness sake, don't impose your views on the rest of society. And of course that's right. In a democratic society, none of us have the right to impose our views on the rest of society. But what we do have the right, and thank God for it, in a democratic society we have the right of free speech. And we have the right to try and persuade others that this is a better way to live, that this is a better way to use technology, that technology needs to be regulated, that there needs to be democratic transparency, that there needs to be democratic debate. So, for instance, one of the things that really troubles me is there's never been any democratic debate about screening for things like Down syndrome. Do we, you know, as a society, have we decided that Down syndrome is such a terrible condition that it should be weeded out of the human race? Mm-hmm. We've never had that debate. It's never been debated in Parliament. There's never been any. It's crept in as the technology has become available. And so this kind of eugenic, some people say it's eugenics by consumerism. It's eugenics by choice, but nonetheless it's still eugenics. It's changing and deliberately changing the genetics of the human race. So yes, I think we do have the right for free speech. We do have the right to persuade others. We have the right to use arguments. And actually, I am not pessimistic. Because what I've discovered in public debates and so on is that there are large swathes of the population, some of them religious, some of them not, who actually have the same understanding that human life is special, that human life is precious, that even a child with disability or genetic disorder is a being to be protected and cared for and loved, and who want to enhance and promote that kind of the appropriate use of technology, but not its manipulative or destructive use. Mm.
And then just very finally, John, kind of linked to that, can you just say something about the fundamental difference it makes to you as someone approaching these issues from a Christian point of view compared to your colleagues who are equally as clever, have the same qualifications, looking at the same evidence, but without the sense that God has spoken into these issues? What, just say something to finish about fundamentally the difference that makes.
Gosh, it's a very good question. It's quite hard to summarise it in the short term. Inevitably, in the end, the way you look at the world changes the way you behave. Mm. And I had a very good colleague who was also a consultant paediatrician on the same neonatal unit, and we often used to talk about life and death. And you know, I used to get teased from time to time for being a religious believer. Like, well, I don't know what's wrong with this baby. You better ask John. He's got the hotline. He'll know. You know, sort of that kind of. But I remember once we were having this conversation, and my friend said to me, "You know, John, when I'm caring for a dying baby." Well, sorry, when you're caring for a dying baby, you're sending them to heaven. When I'm caring for a dying baby, I'm sending them to the rubbish heap. And it was meant as a joke, but actually we both knew it was true. That your ultimate understanding of what it means to be human changes the way in which you care. And for me as a Christian, sort of the realization that God himself had made himself into one of these pathetic little babies changes the way I'm called to care with this attitude of respect. Mm. And I think it reinforces both the tragedy. I mean, I do find that what is going on with, for instance, the selective abortion of babies with Down syndrome, that really hurts me. It hurts me that every year there are hundreds of children with Down syndrome who ought to be here, who ought to be in our midst, and who have been wiped out and eradicated. Mm. So I think having these kind of beliefs and attitudes, it causes me pain, as it does many other people. But I think it also gives me hope, because I do believe that this is not just a random process, that I do believe that there is a God who has given to human beings these wonderful technological abilities, but who ultimately remains in control, and who is we can be co-workers with God. That's this extraordinary concept in Christianity, that together with him, we can be doing his purposes in the world.
John, thank you so much. It's been fascinating. It's important stuff. Sorry we didn't get through all the questions. Feel free to come and try and grab John before he disappears. And as John said, he's put some material at the back. Feel free to have a look at those.